I was here, which might have been the last time we had church here. I don't know. It's just been, I don't know if I would have made it one of those weeks. I was probably going to come and speak and disappear right after church because I was sick, but I might have come anyway and then canceled. But last time I was here, began a series. I said it would be a series on the world of the Bible. And to begin to look into the Bible, or not the Bible itself, but the world of the Bible, to see what kind of a world it was when these books were written. You know, we're just reading from Amos and Obadiah. You know, what was the world like? And we're not going to get there today. We'll get there next time. When Amos began to prophesy there toward the end of Israel's existence, what was it like when Obadiah took up his prophecy against Edom? What was the world? What was going on in the world? And I wanted to learn those things, and I wanted to share them with you. What did the average person think about things? And why did they think that? What were their prevailing worldviews? And does the Bible address them? I talked about context. I showed this picture that, you know, the context matters, or we can get the story wrong. The books of the Bible were written to particular groups of people. They were written at a particular time, in a particular place. They were written for a particular reason. And if we desire to know what the Bible is saying to us, it pays to understand what it was saying to them in the first place. Excuse me. And to understand that, we need to understand their world. The plan is going to be, we already gave one sermon on beginnings. I'm going to summarize that just a little bit in case you weren't here. The second sermon, part of the presentation will be from Egypt to Canaan, the kingdom. That's today. And exile and return will be the third installment, and followed by the intertestamental world, the Greek-speaking world, and finally the New Testament in its Greek and Roman context. So five messages is the plan. Last time we talked about the beginnings. You know, what's the background of the whole book, and in what type of a world was it birthed? And mentioned that, you know, the world of the Bible is very small. It's right there. I could point a laser at it here. It's right there. In the New Testament, it got expanded just a little bit, and that was it. There were plenty of other civilizations in the world, great civilizations, but they're not addressed in the Bible because it's not the subject of the Bible. The Bible does not pretend to be a history book of the entire world. It doesn't need to be, doesn't pretend to be. It's a book about the history of the people of God from the time Abraham was called to the time of Jesus and the apostles. It's not a book to describe what was going on in India, China, or the Western Hemisphere, or anywhere else. So it's their world that we want to learn about. And that's how we're going to better understand the Bible, if we understand more about their world. What kind of questions are answered in the Bible, especially the beginning of the Bible? It's the kind of questions everybody has. Who are we? Who are our neighbors? How did we get here? How did this situation come to be? And excuse me. So in the beginning of the Bible, we read about Moab and Ammon and Edom, you know, as mentioned there today. We read Lot and Esau and their families, Amalek, you know, different people that Israel later on was going to have to deal with are mentioned early on in the book, so we can get an idea of where they all came from and why why things are the way they are today. We talked about the We talked about the nations of the empires of the world, the great powers that existed at the time. I added Hittites there since Jim mentioned Hittites. Hittites are an interesting people, and they occupied Turkey. And there were battles at times between the Hittites and Egyptians. And, of course, Palestine, where Israel ended up, is in the middle. And then it was always in the middle, whether the battle was between Egypt and Babylon or between the Hittites and Egypt or whatever. It was always a crossroads. There's always things happening there. And we have Babylon, we have Egypt. And Assyria was a growing influence. It wasn't there at the beginning, but it certainly was, we'll get into that next time. It was an important part of Israel's history, a negative part. We learned about gods in the ancient world. I read some, you know, maybe too long for some of you, but I read some of the stories from the Enuma Elish and other Mesopotamian creation epics, and we found it in the Babylonian worldview, which is the same worldview that that Abraham came out of, that his family came out of, that the whole Israel, all the Israelites came out of, that in their world there were many gods. These gods were limited for the most part and local, single purpose. They competed with one another. They had very human-like faults. On the other hand, the Bible presents a God called Yahweh who is one, who's unlimited, who is universal and sovereign and omnipotent. And that's not typical of the world. That's different. So the Bible takes what the everyday image is and turns it on its head and says, you know, and it's not like that at all. Not like that at all. And God is not like a man in negative ways. We also saw that the gods of the world were representable. You could make some kind of an image. The god was seen to, or goddess was seen to inhabit the image. Whereas Yahweh cannot be represented. He is beyond his creation. And the gods in Mesopotamia, the way the books were written about them, prioritized their own story. It was about them. The Bible is a different kind of book. It's about us. It's about our ancestors. It's about our relationship with the one God, but it's about us and our potential. It's not about how we're created to somehow fulfill the needs of the gods who were very needy. That's not the Yahweh of the Bible. So, what did we see? We saw a Mesopotamian worldview where the gods were like spoiled humans. Humans, as I said, were here to serve their needs. It was a worldview where the authors and the editors of the book of Genesis were seeking to counter it by describing Yahweh who is not needy and doesn't have the negative characteristics of humans. It's a worldview that, for better or worse, though, Israel inherited. I was in a conversation with somebody, and I want to take a minute here. I don't think I mentioned it here when I was here last time. If I did, I'm sorry, but I want to clarify something. When I say that the authors and editors of the book of Genesis were answering in a way or were writing proactively to answer certain ideas that were out there, I'm not implying that the Enuma Elish came first and somehow the Genesis copied that. That's not my point. My point is that the Mesopotamian culture came first before there was an Israelite culture. And so the Israelite culture did answer. But my point is not that they borrowed necessarily their stories and just tweaked them a little bit. That wasn't my point. And how and when God revealed what he revealed, it was not something I was trying to touch on. Another thing I wanted to point out at the time, and I'm going to mention it again because it's so important, there was no secular world. We live in a world where there's a big divide sometimes between religion and society. And in certain societies where there's not that divide, where we have radicalized Muslims or something like that, we think that's odd and unnatural. That's normal for most of mankind's history. There's just no divide between the religious life and the rest of life. It was all one life, and it involved the gods, and the gods were involved in every aspect of life, and serving them was as normal as getting up and going to bed. It was just part of life. It wasn't a weekend obligation or a one day a week obligation. It was an every day, every hour, every minute obligation to serve the gods. So the gods became part of your very identity, and that's true whether we're talking about pagan gods or Yahweh gods. You went to war under the banner of your god. You took something that represented your god to battle. You didn't do anything without involving the gods. And this has really been the case for most of mankind's history. It's not something that we have now, but we're the exception. The rest of history has been like that. The Bible promotes the worship of Yahweh as the one and true and only and non-human-like God. The Bible recognizes, we talked about, the presence and behind-the-scenes actions of a spirit world. You know, do these false gods exist? Well, in a way they do, because the Bible talks about them and talks about the demonic world and that they have certain powers. Genesis answers those questions. Who are we? How did we get here? How did the nations around us get here? And this is the world from which Abraham came. This is the world in which Israel was born. And their relationship, the Israelites' relationship with God, is the subject of the rest of the Bible. So that's a really, really quick summary of what we covered last time I was here, the last time we were all here. Now, let's talk about Israel, from Egypt to Canaan to kingdom. We're not going to go into the demise of Israel or Judah, but we're going to talk a little bit about the world that existed around the time that Israel became a people with some land. Okay? So, here's the world again. We have, all right, who's up here? The Hittites, right? Hittites were up here. Interesting story about the Hittites. I'll get into them later a little bit. Egyptians, Egyptian Empire down here, one of the greatest empires at times during the second millennium, BC, the most powerful civilization in the world. And you've got Babylon and Mesopotamia here, and you've got the rising power of Assyria in here. And in between all this, you have this land, Palestine. Sometimes we don't like that term Palestine, it comes from the word Philistine. The Philistines live there on the coast, and we'll talk more about them too. So these were the peoples that were around in general in the second millennium BC. This would be, in most parts of this area, what we would call the middle to late Bronze Age. They were using copper, but not iron yet. So you hear about Bronze Age, intermediate or middle Bronze Age or late Bronze Age. This would be the time of the patriarchs. And there was a lot going on. And we'll talk about that. And to me, it's very interesting how history, archaeology, and the Bible all fit together. All right, there's Ur. At least in one place in the Bible, it says that Abraham was from Ur. There's other hints that he may have been from somewhere nearby. But that part of Mesopotamia, from Ur. It was a center of Sumerian culture. It was a happening place with a lot of art and that type of thing going on. But its stability ended early in the early part of the second millennium. And it wasn't restored until Hammurabi's time, which was several hundred years later. And Abraham, well, I'll get there in a second. I just will say that what was going on at this time, because of certain instability in this area, is that people were moving. That's what happens in unstable times, right? You have a depression, a dust bowl. You know, people move. They got to move somewhere where there's work or where there's food or where there's a job. You know, it's always been that way. Well, it was that way back as well. Where there was more opportunity somewhere else, where there was stability somewhere else, or food somewhere else, or work somewhere else, or land where you could feed your sheep or, you know, whatever livestock you had, people would move. They'd move. And that's always been the same. We're very mobile. Egypt, in the beginning of the second century, was a great power. It had its ups and downs, but it was moving into from the intermediate period to what they call the Middle Kingdom, which was a time of great prosperity. And it was a time when they had considerable influence over this area right here, which they weren't very far away. So they always had some influence, and sometimes more than others. And we have archaeological records of that, where they talk about different cities and control and tribute and so forth. Now, what we see in the book of Genesis, in chapter 11, is that Terah says, took Abram, his son, and Lot, his son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife. Sounds like a small group, right? And they went out together from Ur of the Chaldeans in order to enter the land of Canaan. And they went as far as Haran and settled there. Now, I hadn't really paid much attention to this before. You know, I was always thinking, well, God called Abraham, and Abraham left his home, and he's going to go to Canaan. That's not what it says here, does it? Do you catch it? What's it say? It says Terah, his father, who was an idolater, never says he was had any relationship with Yahweh. Terah was on his way to Canaan and took the family. And he got as far as Haran. I can show you. Let's get back to the map here. All right, so it traveled this way. But he was headed this way. Why didn't he go this way? Any ideas?
Bad land.
Hmm?
Bad land.
Yeah, I mean, you got a desert in here. So you're gonna go up the rivers. You got the Euphrates and the Tigris. You get up here, there's the Orontes River here, and you can come back down the coast. And that's the way they went. What we see from history and from what you just saw in the book of Genesis is that at that time, what Terah was doing and what his family was doing was very common. People were moving from here to here. In fact, they were going further than that. We'll get to that in a minute. But this was a path of migration. And so what you had and what you find is that in this area, you had people that were from here. So they had something in common. They had language in common. They had background in common. And yes, there were people that already lived here, but you had people moving here. And many of those who moved, according to the archaeologists, were what we call nomads. They really weren't into building towns and settling down. They had flocks, they had herds, and they moved around from place to place. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, perfect example of that. The only land we have record of them buying was to bury their dead in, the cave, right? Other than that, they just kind of moved around. Well, that was typical because the type of people that were moving, that were doing this moving, tended to be nomadic at this time. So when they got to Canaan, they didn't necessarily build a town or a village. They just found the good land and took care of their flocks. Excuse me. Now, so from Haran, then later on, we read in Genesis 12 that God called Abram to go to Canaan and worship him there. So the Bible says that he left Haran after his father died. And it sounds kind of like you got Abram, you got Sarai, you got Lot, you got a handful of people, right? It sounds like just a few people, you know, a couple of donkeys and a few goods. I don't think so. Why don't I think so? Remember in Genesis 14 when there was this confederation of kings, and you got to realize these kings were just kings, small-time operators, small villages and so forth. But they had four or five of them and got together and involved in a battle, and Lot got caught up in it. And he was captured, and Abraham had to rescue him. You remember that story? What did Abraham do? You know, beat on his chest and go, you know, grab a sword and go run after him? No, he grabbed 300 and some people that were his own people. And he didn't have any kids, at least none that we know about it yet. So these are people born in his own household, is whatever you want to call them, slaves, servants, shepherds, whatever. And 300 of them were capable of carrying a weapon and going to battle. So how many people did he leave? Well, I don't know. But he had at least 300 men later on when he decided to, he had to go to battle. So, and I would suspect, I can't prove this, that he was not atypical. In other words, people that left were people of means. Those are the people that could afford to move, right? They've got stuff, they've got money, they've got goods, they've got animals, they've got whatever it takes to wealth in order to make the trip. So there were people like Abram that were making this trip from this area here, what we call a Fertile Crescent, all the way up and back down. And I think I got an aerial photo here just to kind of bring this to life a little bit. There you go. Now this is, I don't know exactly where Shechem is, I just put a star that's kind of in the area. But, you know, Abraham had come this way, this away. You know, he'd come from over, came down the coast, past Mount Hermon in here and so on. So you could see, just for get your bearings, the Sea of Galilee, you got the Dead Sea, you got the Jordan River in between. So Jericho would be down here, Jerusalem would be sitting up here. It's hard to tell from this picture. I have another one later. I like maps. If you don't like maps, that's fine. Just ignore these, but this will give you an idea of the terrain. And when Israel went to Palestine and began to live there, they didn't live in the best part of the land necessarily. You had coastal plain here, down low. You had a plain going through here. And the plains are where you had many travel lanes, you might say. The Silk Road from Asia kind of went down here and came through and went to Egypt. You have a valley in here, but you got a lot of highland. This is all highland, rugged, and very rugged from the highland down into the Rift Valley here. You've got highlands in here, Reuben and Gad and half tribe Manasseh settled later, Transjordan. So you've got some rough areas, and you've got areas where people didn't really want to settle because it was rough. And the geography comes into play later. That's why I'm bothering to mention it a little bit now. It matters later when you read certain things about the history of Israel. The fact that they live, for the most part, in the upper lands, up in the hills, and sometimes their enemies were down here on the coast where it was flat, that made a difference. That made a difference. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. Okay. Not only did these, and we'll call them Asiatics, okay? I don't know. You can call them what you want, but one of the terms that's used is Asiatics. Not only did these an Asiatic would be compared to an Egyptian, all right, who's coming from down this way, down in Africa. So these Asiatics would travel, and some of them would go through Canaan and come down here to the Delta region. And there was a large population of Asiatics in the Delta region of Egypt. And they were there before Abraham got there, and they were coming when Abraham and or Isaac and Jacob, you know, when the patriarchs got there, and they were still coming after that. Egypt, in fact, and you may have heard this before, there was a time in the middle part of the century, for about 100 years, from maybe 1650 to 1550, that Egypt, or let's say Lower Egypt down here, was ruled by people called Hyksos, if I'm saying that correctly. The Hyksos, and that's just a word that means kind of foreign rulers. But they weren't just any foreign rulers. They were Asiatic rulers. They were from here. They were from the east. They were Asiatics. And they took control. There were enough of them that could take control and kind of invade it and control Lower Egypt for over 100 years. Now, later on, they got pushed out. They had different capitals. The dynasties of Egypt weren't necessarily separate. Sometimes there was one in Lower Egypt at Memphis or, you know, where Cairo is now. And sometimes there was one up at Thebes. And sometimes they existed at the same time. Sometimes one was weak, one was strong, and so forth. Well, anyway, the ones that were at Thebes finally pushed out the Hyksos. And since the Hyksos were foreigners, and not only just foreigners, but they were Asiatic to boot, you know, they were these, whatever you want to call it, you know, they're civilized, you might say. Although they did bring some inventions and some things to Egypt. But what happened back in those days, and you've heard this before, and if you watch Exodus, you can see it, they would wipe out the history, things they didn't want known. So since the Hyksos didn't end up winning, every reference to them that we have in Egyptian history is a negative one from the people who did push them out. All right? So you have these Hyksos, and they're actually Asiatic. So you have a lot of people living in this area that are from over here, and actually for a period of time, we had leaders of Egypt that were from somewhere over here. We don't know where from. They don't know exactly who the Hyksos were and so forth. Now, knowing that, just put this up, you know, in your brain. You remember later on it says there was a Pharaoh who didn't know Joseph, and you know we need to enslave these Asiatic people we've got here. It just makes sense if you know about the Hyksos that they could be thinking, not again. You know, we had to fight them off one time already. We don't want to get taken over by these people because there's so many of them. Have some Hyksos or somebody like them come back and control us again. It was in their recent memory. And it makes sense to me anyway that that would be something that would be on their mind, that they would want to avoid that happening again. Why did people go to Egypt? Why did Isaac go to Egypt? Why did Abraham go to Egypt on occasion? What did Egypt have?
Food.
Why do they have food? There's a one or two word answer to that.
They had the Nile.
They had the Nile. Here's a satellite picture. Isn't that neat? Here you've got the Mediterranean. You've got the Red Sea down here. And look at the Nile River. Green. And what do you have on this side? Brown. What do you got on this side? Brown. Now that's a picture from today. That's no different than it was 3,000 years ago, other than it's dammed up now and it wasn't then. So without a dam, what happened every single year?
It flooded.
And all this land to the side was flooded. And you got all this wonderful fertilizer put there, plus water. And it didn't matter whether there was a drought here or here or here or there. You can have drought everywhere, but you're going to have food in Egypt, at least most of the time. Now we read, you know, during the time of Joseph, there was a time when they even had a drought for whatever reason. But that was a rarity, maybe a miracle from God at the time. In general, you always had a flood, you always had a crop. So no matter where else there was a problem, you could go to Egypt and get some food. And I love this picture. And notice where else it's green, the delta. So I don't know whether you could live, you know, maybe there's certain parts of that are just too wet to live in, I'm not familiar. But somewhere down in this region is where the Israelites ended up. But they weren't alone, because for centuries prior to their arrival, and during their time of their arrival, and afterwards, there were other people from Asia that were migrating down here and staying here. Why did they stay here instead of closer to Memphis or Thebes? What did Joseph tell his family? You better stay here because, what was the problem? Why did they need to stay away from the rest of the Egyptians? Go ahead.
They were shepherds.
Because they had animals. Yeah. They had the animals, and if you've heard Hugh, I think Hugh might have given a sermon here about the Apis bull and how they worshiped. You know, the Egyptians were crazy about their animal worship, especially bulls. So the fact that you have people here to raise them and actually kill them and ate them, that wasn't, you know, that didn't fit well with the culture. So Joseph said, "You better live down here." Well, again, his family wasn't alone. All these Asiatics that happened to be nomads, that happened to have livestock, settled in the same area. And they all became slaves when it was time to enslave them because of the fear of another Hyksos occupation, perhaps. So that was interesting to me also, that Israelites were not alone. And the Bible actually tells us that, and we'll get to that in a little bit. In the latter part of the second millennium, we're getting, you know, down into the 1500s, 1400s, or whatever, 1300s. Egypt was still powerful. The Hittite Empire was still powerful. And they vied for control of Palestine and the area up in here, which we might call Syria today. Egypt, for the most part, had control or the most influence, but by the end of the 1200s, by the time we get to the 1100s, for some reason or another, and we don't know all the details, the Hittite Empire had collapsed. There's hardly any record of what happened after that. No written records. It just collapsed. The theory is that there were these people called Sea People. Where they came from, who they were, not really sure. Some people connect them with the Phoenicians. Don't really know. But the Hittite Empire had fallen, and it was not to be revived. It was a powerful, huge empire, but it was not to be revived. So once Israel comes on the scene as a people and as a nation, the Hittites are no longer a factor, even though they're up there. What you have is a rising power in Assyria. There was actually a large war between one of the Ramses, and I forget the guy's name, the Hittite, when the Egyptians were trying to push the frontier up here a little bit and close the Hittites. And they had a war in Kadesh on the Orontes, which is near where Antioch is. And it's one of the first battles that we have a lot of records of, because there are monuments in Egypt. According to Ramses, it was a great victory, great battle, blah, blah, blah. The historians are not so sure, because obviously you're not going to say, "I had a terrible battle and this happened and it was bad." But there's other evidence that maybe things didn't go as well for Ramses as what he claims. The estimates are there might have been as many as 20 or 30,000 soldiers, troops on each side. That was a tremendously large battle for those days. Tremendously large. If those numbers are even accurate, but that's huge. Anything else I want to say about this? Any questions? Anytime you have something to say, just go ahead. Because I'm going to keep racing through it. So the Hittite Empire was no longer a factor shortly after the time of the Exodus. And we don't know exact time. I don't know the exact dates. But by the time Israel gets to be an entity, there's no Hittite Empire to worry about anymore. Although there's still Hittites around, I guess. But there's no empire that they are controlling. I got this map because it showed a couple things I wanted to show. Because before Israel started to settle in these areas, there were two other groups of people, one we just read about in Obadiah, Edom and Moab, that hadn't been there before, or at least hadn't been there in terms of a nation, that kind of, I don't know what the right word is, but became nations, became entities that had central control and so forth. And that would be Edom and Moab. And they both came into play during the Exodus. But here you are again with the, you got the Jordan Valley here, you got the Dead Sea, Jerusalem would be up here. And so this is on the in the Jordanian side of the rift there. And you have two nations that, according to Genesis, are related to the Israelites through Esau and through Lot. Now I want to discuss something that might be controversial. I'm just going to throw it out there. It's something I've battled with for years and kind of dealt with in the last few years. If you disagree with me, that's fine. I'm not going to, it doesn't bother me. In Numbers chapter 20 and verses 14 to 17, Moses sends messengers to the king of Edom. This is during the Exodus. They're reaching the end of their wandering. And he says, "Your brother Israel has said, 'You know the hardship that has befallen us, how our fathers went down to Egypt, and we stayed in Egypt a long time, and the Egyptians treated us badly, our fathers badly. But when we cried to the Lord, he heard our voice and sent an angel and brought us out of Egypt. Now behold, we are at Kadesh,'" not the same Kadesh I was mentioning before, "'a town on the edge of your territory. Please let us pass through your land. We will not pass through field or through vineyard. We will not even drink water from a well. We will go along the king's highway, not turning to the right or left until we pass through your territory.'" Now, I've read this for years, and I used to just stick it up on a shelf. Edom's answer, by the way, was no, you can't. And it caused them to have a discouraging detour, because they were, had come, you know, this far, and they had to go around Edom instead of entering into what the promised land this way. They had to go around, and ended up coming up this way through Jericho. So it made their trek longer. So they weren't thrilled about that, obviously. Well, Edom said no. Well, I'm going to go back and look at this verse. I have preached before, and I'm not going to preach again, that there were 2 to 3 million people, 2 to 3 million Israelites on the Exodus. Practically speaking, 2 to 3 million people cannot march on the highway, not touch the right or the left, drink out of a well, or mess up anything. You're talking about Chicago. You're talking about the Baltimore, Washington metropolitan area, everybody in it. It doesn't seem to me to be possible, based on what the Bible itself says. In fact, here's another one. Deuteronomy 7:7. "The Lord did not send his love on you or choose you because you were more in number than any of the peoples, for you were the fewest of all peoples." The estimated population of Egypt at the time of the Exodus is about 2 or 3 million. Not very likely, in my opinion, that the Israelite population was equal to the Egyptian population. Where do we get that 2 to 3 million? Because we read in our translations of the Bible that says there were 600,000 men that were able to be troops, you know, the able-bodied men that could be fighters. Excuse me. That would have been a humongous army at that time. There would have been no battles, and they wouldn't have had to fight with these villages they came up to. But in any event, the word that's translated 1,000 and 600,000 is most of the time translated 1,000 in the Bible. It's not always translated that. It's possible it could be translated something like clan or something like that, that it could have a meaning that involves less people. I don't know the answer. I just am saying that according to Deuteronomy 7:7, God himself says that you know Israel was the fewest of all peoples. And 2 to 3 million people at that time would not have been the fewest of all peoples. It would have been a huge nation on the scale of Egypt. So you can do the math if you're interested. I've done it. You can get out a calculator in the back of an envelope and figure out some other things. I think we ought to, this is my opinion, but I think we ought to consider smaller numbers for the Exodus both from internal biblical evidence that I just presented and also from other evidence. I just think you ought to, maybe we ought to reconsider it if those things are interesting to you. If they're not, just ignore what I just said. They're interesting to me. For a long time, I struggled with it, and finally I said, you know, God says there weren't that many people, so I've got it wrong. I can't say 2 to 3 million people because it couldn't have been. That's a lot of people. That's not few people. Who left Egypt? Well, I've kind of answered this already. It says in Exodus 12:38, a mixed multitude went up with them, along with flocks and herds and a very large number of livestock. What do you mean mixed multitude? There was a mixed multitude already there. There were all kinds of people who had emigrated into Egypt and into the Delta area. And when it's time, when God freed his people, Israel, the rest of them came along. It says that right there. It also says in Numbers 11:4, not very complimentary, the rabble who were among them had greedy desires. And all the sons of Israel wept again and said, who will give us meat to eat? So we have two different groups of people here. We have sons of Israel and we have the rabble. Whoever you want to call the rabble, that's everybody else, I guess. But the point is, there was a large group of people that came out of Egypt, and it wasn't all sons of Israel. Some of them were the rabble, or the mixed multitude. So we have to remember that there were many Semitic peoples who had migrated to Egypt, who were eventually enslaved along with the Israelites, and they all left together. And they all migrated to Canaan together. And you know, how did that work? Well, they were kind of kinfolk. I mean, they came from the same part of the world. So they had certain things in common. Excuse me. How did they get there? Well, we don't know exactly. Get back to this picture. You know, they were in this area, in the Delta, and they were headed here. Now, that's just a short walk up the... I say short walk. Who am I to say short walk? But compared to how far they did walk, it's a short walk. It's a short walk up the coast. But remember what got it's Moses who knew better. Moses, according to Josephus, was a general, an Egyptian general. So he knew what was what. And I want to mention a few things about that, by the way. He says they shouldn't go up the way of the Philistines. Why? Because they'd see war and get discouraged and turn around, go back. Why would they see war going up this way? Well, because it was the way of the Philistines. Who were the Philistines? Don't really know. I mean, we know who they ended up being. Where did they come from? Don't know. I'm going to talk about it later, so I don't want to get into it now. But they were in this area. I will say this much. There's speculation and evidence that it always mentions five cities, right? And I'll show you. We got a picture here. Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, and two that aren't on here, Gath and Eglon. Is that the other one? Five. It always mentions five cities. Now, the thinking is that these Philistines were kind of what you might call professional fighters. Not every Philistine, obviously, but that initially they were fighters. That they might have been Hittites, might have been from the Hittite Empire, and there's a reason for that. And that Egypt itself might have garrisoned them up here to protect their frontier. You got Egypt down here, right? So you put these professional soldiers here, give them some land, give them some cities, and you know, live there, have a good life, and take care of our interests while you're here. And they were good soldiers. They were good soldiers. In fact, later on, they were a big pain in the rear end for the Israelites. They were their main enemy for certain reasons. They seem to be professional organized fighters. Unlike the typical Canaanite who was worried more about their you know, trying to grow some food or take care of their livestock or whatever it was. The Philistines were from a different background and had a different mindset. The Philistines were not subdued until far long into David's time. So they were, you know, as Israel settled in the land, the Philistines were always here. And they were almost always a problem. And why wouldn't they be? You know, with another more people coming in and trying to push them, you know, push them into the sea a little bit. Here's another picture. I wish I could have got a bigger one. But this shows the geography a little bit, too. You've got this deep valley that's below sea level. You've got the coast. You've got the plain going across here that I mentioned. And then you've got highlands here, and you've got highlands here. And the highland wasn't all that attractive. But that's the area that ended up being settled by the Israelites first, other than, well, even high land on this side of the Jordan. Because they didn't have to fight for it as much, put it that way. That's where they ended up. Some areas were not assimilated until the time of David's reign. Jerusalem, for instance, which was Jebusite fortress, was not taken over until David's time. And the way you read, and I'm not going to talk a whole lot about it, but the way you read about David had his band, you know, his musket, what are they, the musketeers, you know, he had a whole lot of them, he had hundreds of them. But his battles, as he rose to power in Israel, were personal battles for the most part. And when he took over Jerusalem, it was his. It wasn't Israel's or Judah's, it was David's. It was the city of David. Why? Because he took it over with his men and his power. It was his. Now, it became the capital of Judah. But that's not how it started. It was David's city. And I hadn't thought about that before, but it says it right in the Bible, the city of David. It was his. And he took control of it by his own power with his own men. He was a great warrior. So, Israel begins to settle, but it settles more in the highlands. And as it settled, you know, in Joshua we have an account, and I'm not going to get into all this, but we have accounts of different battles that take place. But there's just a few, and then it's kind of over, and Joshua divvies the land up. And then when you read later in the book of Joshua, and also in the book of Judges, Israel never controlled that land necessarily. It was there, you can have this part, you can have that part, this family can have that part, but they had to kind of take it over themselves or kind of just move in and settle. And a lot of times their neighbors were people just like them. And they became part of the nation in a sense, although it wasn't a nation yet. And there's no reason why that shouldn't be. Everybody can, just get along together. They had similar backgrounds. They had animals. They had whatever. So Israel moves in from this direction. They settle a little bit. They have the 2.5 tribes on this side. And then they move in. But they can't occupy everything. In fact, Dan can't take over part of the land that's allotted to it at all and has to take over some other land. Other tribes don't, are kind of assimilated. Simeon kind of gets assimilated into Judah. Levi doesn't get a territory at all. So it's a mixed bag, but it's not as if the army just kept marching and just wiping people out. Had a little bit of that at the beginning, especially here in the Transjordan. But after a while, it just becomes a matter of settlement and getting along with people. You don't have a record of continual wars and of getting rid of people or a harem where you've got to kill everybody. You had certain instances where that happened, but that becomes rare as you move through Joshua and Judges. Okay. Now, briefly, just going to go through a little bit of the history here. How were the people bound if it wasn't a nation, if you didn't have a king or a boss? Well, they were bound by a covenant. They had a covenant. They made a covenant at Sinai, the ones who were in the Exodus. When they arrive in the land, the people that are there, don't have a quibble with it, they can add Yahweh to whoever they worship, and they can be part of the covenant in that sense too. They can obey the laws, and they had a shared history. They all had emigrated from somewhere else. So there was a bond there, but it wasn't a controlling bond, right? There was nobody in control forcing a certain way on everybody. It was a bond of brotherhood and covenant. And we have the whole book of Judges where you have basically confusion reigning, right? You've got, as soon as there's one problem solved in this particular area of the land, we got a problem somewhere else. And then the Philistines are acting up on the coast, and somebody else is acting up. And God raises up Gideon, or God raises up Deborah and Barak, or God raises up Jephthah, or whatever. And some of these people that, quote-unquote, I'm saying God raised up, they, like Jephthah, were no better than a everyday kind of crook anyway. But God used whoever. Samson himself was a very flawed person that God was able to use. The Bible, interestingly, and this is very interesting to me, and the more I read the Bible, the more I am impressed by it. The Bible preserves both sides of the king, what I'm calling a king, no king debate. And by that, I mean there were some people, like you read the book of Judges, it says every man did what was right in his own eye because there was no king in Israel in those days. Whoever wrote that phrase kind of thought having a king was a good thing. But then you've got Samuel writing, or whoever wrote the story there, and you have, it's a bad idea. God never wanted a king. And here's what a king's going to do, blah, blah, blah. Or Moses himself is saying, here's what a king's going to do. You don't want a king. And then on the other hand, you've got David, the king, who's going to, dynasty is going to go on forever, and Messiah is going to come from him. So it seems to me that within Israel itself, you've got this battle going on, this philosophical battle, perhaps, as to whether or not having a king is a good thing or not. Do we really want a king? You know, we don't really want somebody telling us what to do and taxing us and all that kind of a very American approach to things. But this, to me, is one of the aspects of the Bible that makes it so credible and believable that it preserves both sides of some of the debates that are there. To me, that's interesting. You read the story of David and his rise to the throne. It's a bag full of all kinds of stuff. Some of it's good, some of it's bad. You know, if you were in charge of writing the Bible and your side won, you're on David's side, you wouldn't have all that bad stuff in there, or vice versa. But it's all there. Well, I don't know if it's all there, but there's enough of it there that proves to me the authenticity of the Bible. That, you know, we've got different voices that are preserved. And we can read both sides of the debate. Not everybody was crazy about having a king. And the people who were okay with having a king because, well, I'll get there in a minute. Samuel himself sometimes seems to be pro-king, and sometimes to be anti-king. And sometimes pro, depending on, you know, I'm pro-Saul and I'm anti-Saul. Why did they have a king in the first place? Well, they needed to have a king, they thought, because it was a time of crisis. The Philistines were the problem. The Philistines are on the coast, right? And there's a battle, and the Philistines, the professional fighters, they've got the upper hand. And Israel can't handle them. And there's several reasons why Israel can't handle them. We'll get to that in a minute. But even though Saul becomes king, he doesn't raise a professional army that follows him around all the time. He doesn't heavily tax the people, doesn't have a levy on the people, he doesn't have a draft. He's king, but he's kind of king to take care of the problems that are there. He's kind of a, well, I don't know what you'd call that. He's appointed to take care of what problems we have. And when he dies in battle, it's not immediately clear that one of his sons is supposed to be the next king. Israel doesn't have the idea of this, what do you want to call it, dynastic succession yet. They're not fully in the king category. They've still got a little bit of no king going on here. So when Saul dies, it's not a given that his sons are going to continue. So it's not the typical world empire monarchy that they would see around them. David rises to power as I would call as a bit of a rogue. He's got his own personal fighting force. They're not supported by the government. And how does he support them? We call it extortion today. You know, it's protection money. We'll protect your sheep shearers if you give us some food. What does it mean if he doesn't protect the sheep shearers? It means the sheep shearers are going to have some problems, you know. And they know that. So, you know, is that godly? And, you know, I'm not trying to make David look bad, but the point is that the Bible itself gives us all these details. David, at least when he started out, he had some negative sides to him. And it's preserved for us in the Bible. It's amazing. And even with David's children, he had all these different children, because what he did, he tried to ally himself with everybody. So he married this woman, married that woman, married this woman, and he's got all these kids from different women, and they all think they're going to be the next king. And they give him all kinds of trouble, including one that out and out rebels against him. So it was a mess still, even under David. And it still wasn't clear just what was going to go on and how we're going to handle this king thing. To me, that's interesting. I don't know if I want to say any more about that yet. Okay. What was the world like in the time of David and Solomon and Saul? Well, what you have found, I already mentioned to you, the Hittites were gone. They were history. The Egyptians were in a period of weakness. Babylon was in a period of weakness. And Assyria was growing in power, but not powerful yet. I've got a great big Assyria there, but really it wasn't that. It was a lot smaller thing. So what you had is a time when it was a perfect time, really, for Israel to begin society, follow God's law, do it right, and have the godly blessings. Of course, Israel was made up of human beings just like us, and they didn't do that. And most of her issues then, her battles, her problems were local, like the Philistines. She wasn't having to go to war against Egypt or go to war against Babylon. That wasn't the case. And Assyria was not a power that needed to be reckoned with yet. That was going to come, as we read about in Amos. Now, how about some local little tidbits about what it was like? You read about chariots. We read about them way back in the Exodus. The Egyptians had chariots. And then you read about them other times. It talks about in Judges, the beginning of the book of Judges, it says, the Lord was with Judah, and they took possession of the hill country. Remember the hill country, right? Right, going up from the Rift Valley that I showed you. Judah took possession of the hill country. One of the reasons they could take possession of it is that nobody else wanted it. It was rugged and hilly. But they could not drive the inhabitants out of the valley because they had iron chariots. And so what you have in Israel, as Israel becomes a power, is you have sometimes the enemies, like the Philistines, have iron chariots, or somebody else down in the valley has iron chariots. Israel doesn't, because what kind of army did Israel have? David had his mighty men, right? And they rode right along beside him, or walked right along beside him, however they did. It was an infantry force. And that's how they fought. And that's why they weren't terribly successful against the Philistines, because when you got down in the valley near the coast, what did you have? You had flat land, and the chariots worked down there. And there's another thing. They had iron chariots, and we'll mention a little bit more about that in a minute. There's a battle that's talked about in 2 Samuel. It says, David defeated Hadadezer, the son of Rahab, king of Zobah, as he went to restore his rule at the river. David captured from his 1,700 horsemen and 20,000 foot soldiers, David hamstrung the chariot horses, but reserved enough of them for 100 chariots. David, given in a sense a gift in battle of all these horses and all these chariots, killed the horses because he didn't have any use for them. Because why? Because he controlled the highlands. And you can't, up in those, it was too rugged. You couldn't use the chariots up there. He kept some, but in general he didn't keep them because they weren't of use to him, and it wasn't the kind of war he was used to fighting. It wasn't what his guys were good at. That's just an interesting little tidbit to me there, that they had, you know, David was used to battling in the highlands and used to commanding foot soldiers. It mentions iron chariots. Get this interesting scripture in 1 Samuel. It says that no blacksmith could be found in all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, otherwise the Hebrews will make swords or spears. So all Israel went down to the Philistines, each to sharpen his plowshare, his mattock, and his axe, and his hoe. And the charge was 2/3 of a shekel for the plowshares and so forth. So it came at the day of battle that neither, now this was a battle where Saul and his men were going to fight the Philistines, and no sword nor spear was found in the hands of any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan, but they were found with Saul and his son Jonathan only. So Jonathan and Saul had some kind of iron sword or spear, but the rest of the army didn't. And what we find from history is that in the ancient Near East, guess who was the first society or civilization to pass from the Bronze Age into the Iron Age? Anybody know? It was the Hittites. Now, it didn't do a lot of good for them because it didn't last, but if they had iron first. They were the first civilization in that area to be able to work iron. When we say Bronze Age and Iron Age and this age and that age, you know, the Stone Age, it's not the same year in every part of the world. It just depends on when they quit using stone and started using copper, or when they quit using copper and started using iron. And that happened at different times in different places. But in the Near East, the Hittites, somewhere toward the end of their history, were the first in the area to begin to work iron. And so that leads to some speculation that perhaps the Philistines were somehow connected with the Hittites, because they had this going for themselves too. And we don't really know where they came from. And they're on the coast there, and so they have access to the Hittites. Don't know. But once they had that control and that knowledge, they tried to make sure that the Israelites didn't get it. And the Israelites didn't get it until the time of David. You know, so Israel kind of passes into the Stone Age somewhere around, into the Iron Age, somewhere around 1000 B.C., rather than the Hittites, who were there a couple hundred years before that, and the Philistines. So iron was a rare thing. that has a lot to do with battles and who's going to win, too. And, you know, you're going to fight the Philistines, and all you have is sticks and stones and maybe some copper-headed spears, and they've got iron swords and spears and so forth. It's a big difference. It's a big difference. So we don't know how that connection with it, whether there was really a connection with the Hittites, but the Philistines had the iron and they had control of the production of it, at least until David came along. David, you read David's history, it's amazing. Eventually, and you know the history, Israel became two kingdoms. Israel was the dominant. Judah had less people, had less territory. They did have an enduring Davidic dynasty. The children of David continued to be the kings. In Israel, it was not that at all. It was not that at all. In Israel, we go through dynasties, just like going through Oreo cookies or something. As soon as one guy was king, he's dead, and it's the next somebody that didn't like him, when the king's dead, kill everybody that was related to the king, and he'd start his own dynasty. And that one would last one generation or two, and then it'd be the same thing again. There was one dynasty that did last a little while. That was the dynasty of Omri. We even see Omri in inscriptions in the Middle East. And Omri expanded the power of Israel. Israel was a great nation under Omri and his sons. And they had considerable power and influence in the region at that time. But all the while this is going on, Assyria is gaining in power. And it's going to be the rod of God's anger, as we read and probably already have read in the Bible reading. And time is running out. Time is running out. So, to summarize, there were mass migrations from Mesopotamia into Canaan and even into Egypt. It was not just Abram. There were lots of people coming and from the same place that Abram came from and going to the same places. People of similar backgrounds as Abram and his family were settled in both Canaan and in Egypt in the Delta region. Many of them ended up as slaves in Egypt, and many were still in Canaan when Joshua and the people arrived. And these were people that of a similar background. It wasn't like they were total foreigners. They'd all come from the same area. There were some that, you know, native, you might say, Canaanites that had been there already. But you also had many, many immigrants. The Exodus, in my opinion, was a smaller event than we have tended to picture it. But the most important thing about the Exodus, and this is the whole Bible revolves around this, is that it was a defining event. It is what made the people of Israel, because God chose them and God removed them from Egyptian slavery. So regardless of how many of them there were, it was the single event that defined who Israel was. And they kept that close to them all through their history. And you read it again and again after the time of the Exodus. It was the defining event in the creation of a nation. The Bible includes voices from both sides of many issues. King, no king, as I said, Saul, David, whether he was worthy to be king or not, if you go through his history. I think this adds to the Bible's authenticity because it preserves the different voices. God used ongoing migration patterns, the ups and downs of different nations, to provide opportunities for his own people and to accomplish his purpose in his time. Does God micromanage the world to make it happen? I'm not saying he did or didn't. I don't know. But the time was right for Israel when Israel came on the scene. Israel had a break from foreign domination and had a real chance to establish something good under David and Solomon. Didn't establish what they could have. Whoops, I had one more there. Israel and Judah, like their neighbors, had their ups and downs. And unfortunately, their decline was inevitable because they disobeyed God. So next time, we'll talk about the world of the Bible in terms of the exile of the people from the land and the return of some of them, and also the what's called the diaspora, that some of them did not return, and you know, what was their life like. So we'll get into that a little bit, and that sets the stage for the New Testament.